Hello. In this audio snippet, we were supposed to continue talking about the post-Civil War period, and we have been promising to someday talk about the effort by Grant to annex Santo Domingo to the U.S. And there's a lot to say there, and it also had a great influence on what happened to Black America and the Republican Party going forward after that period. And we do need to get to that. I feel like sometimes like Ulysses S. Grant and Charles Sumner are sitting on a ship deck off the coast of Santo Domingo, and they're there sitting there waiting for me to show up and to tell the story about what happened with the two of them and the Dominican Republic and Santo Domingo and all of that. And I seem to never show up to tell the story, but I feel that we need to talk about something else before we get to that. And even though it's not directly related in a very kind of direct sense to the history of Black America or America, I hope you will see that it is related to Black America, everything we're about to say, and it ties in with everything we've said in all these recent audio snippets about Black America and America in general. So we're going to talk about two things, and the two things we're going to talk about will seem unrelated, completely unrelated, but I hope also that by the end of this audio snippet, you will see that they really are very intertwined. So the first thing that we'd like to talk about is what you might find to be a very strange thing to talk about, but and it has to do with a certain actor. He's an actor, also a singer, I think, and a comedian. Sometimes they portray him as a comedian, but he's more than a comedian. He's a character actor. And his name is Chai McBride. I think that's how they pronounce it. His actual name is Kenneth McBride, but they call him Chai because apparently, he was born in Chicago, and I think that's where he got that nickname of Chai, as in Chai-town, a common nickname for Chicago. So this actor, who happens to be a black man, he's a tall black man. He's bald, and you may recognize him maybe from if you're familiar with shows from the late 80s, early 90s. You might have seen him on the John Larroquette show. He was the janitor in that St. Louis bus station or whatever it was. He's also been in many shows, like he was on the TV show House, the show starring the British actor Hugh Laurie. He was there for a few episodes as this wealthy man who had, I think, bought the hospital that ran that House worked in, Gregory House, and he acted like this tyrant and made House's life miserable. And as I would watch those episodes, I grew to hate him, hate Chai McBride, but not the actor, but the character he was playing, because he was playing it so well. There's a certain aura about him. There's a certain aura of authority that he carries, and there's a reason for that. And recently, almost by accident, I stumbled on a story about him that appeared on a show called Celebrity Ghost Stories, where these celebrities talk about their quote paranormal experiences and things, strange things that have happened to them. And this actor, Chai McBride, was sharing that he many years ago, back in 1988, he had this strange experience, and I would like to share it from memory, but it would be too diffuse and too poorly described. So what I'm going to do is going to take the short way, shortcut, and basically read a brief narration of what happened to him on a website that I found. I did a quick search, so if you want to look up that link, if you do some search such as Chai McBride 1988 Experience Memphis Motel, if you do a search on those words, you might find this story near the top of the search results. But sorry, before we get into what happened to him, I'd like to share a little bit about his background. He was born, as we said before, in Chicago, and he was raised a Seventh-day Adventist. And he even attended a school called Shiloh Academy that apparently is now known as Chicago SDA Academy, and SDA stands for Seventh-day Adventist. And it says on his bio on Wikipedia that after he studied, he liked music from the beginning, so he studied several instruments, and he also sang with gospel choirs in Chicago. But then he decided to move from Chicago and go to live in Atlanta, Georgia in 1986. To work as a billing clerk. And it's interesting that he chose Atlanta, Georgia. As we've shared so many times before, there's something very powerful about the calling that that Georgia had. Georgia was supposed to be the place from which slavery was going to end. And we've talked about this a million times, so we're not going to go into all those details. And because of that calling, that mantle on Georgia, Atlanta, in particular, has a very important role to play, shall we say, with regard to the liberation of black people. And that's why Martin Luther King was born in I think he was born in, I'm not sure if he was born in Atlanta, but I do know he was born in Georgia. I think he was born in Atlanta, but and so that's not a coincidence that this call for freedom or change in black America it seems to kind of stem out or kind of pour forth out of Georgia. That at least that's what it was supposed, how it was supposed to be, and that's why Atlanta is a place where so many rich black people live. It's as if in Atlanta, the American dream has been, quote, partially realized. For many black people, that's where they, where it is more or less normal, for lack of a better expression, to be a black American who can dream to be wealthy and prosperous and live a wealthy life instead of living the stereotypical ghetto life or whatever. So I'm not sure why he really decided to move to Atlanta, Georgia, but I do believe there that it's not a coincidence that he ended up going there for a time. And so he was in Atlanta, Georgia, working as a billing clerk for a phone company. But his heart was in his dream was to get into show business and music or whatever. And it says on his bio that his first success in show business was a song, never heard of it to be frank, called Basically He Is the Champ. He was part of this group called KSL, the letters KSL. And the song was like a parody about the marriage between Mike Tyson, you know, the heavyweight boxer with the funny voice, and the actress Robin Givens. And the song was successful enough that he was signed by Esquire Records, and then he ended up joining an R&B band called Covert. So he was starting to have some success musically speaking, but he felt that he wanted to go further and he wanted to go into an acting career. So he moved to Los Angeles, and somehow he started landing guest roles on various shows. He ended up on appearing on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and In Living Color and other shows. And he started making his presence felt, and he ended up even being on films. I think he co-starred with Bruce Willis on some movie and so forth. So he started having the success, and I'm sharing this to show how this man was living his life with a purpose. It's as if, you know, he started in Chicago, went to Atlanta as if to go get something from Atlanta, to be kind of invigorated with something. And then from Atlanta, he went on to Los Angeles to kind of blossom in his show business career. I was listening to this story that was on this Celebrity Ghost Stories show, and he was narrating what had happened to him. And I'm going to read part of what's on this website called mandatory.com. As I mentioned earlier, if you do a search on the terms Chai McBride 1988 experience Memphis Motel, you might find this link near the top of the search results. And the title of the link is Seven Comedians Share Their Most Terrifying Ghost Stories. And so if you scroll down, you'll eventually find the narration of his story. And I want to share what's said here, and then share what is not written here on this website, and share what he said after narrating what had happened to him. So I'm just going to read it. It says, actor and comedian Chai McBride was busing across the country to see his children in the late 80s. He stopped in Memphis on a layover. He decided to go for a walk with no destination in mind. And please bear that in mind. He decided to go for a walk with no destination in mind. Okay, so then it says, it was 5:45 a.m. and the city was ghostly quiet. McBride felt personally as though he was being pulled somewhere, as if someone or something was pushing him forward. There were no sounds in the town until a bus pulled up alongside him and offered him a ride. He got in, and the bus driver drove him to a nearby hotel and left him off. Once there, McBride discovered it was the Lorraine Motel, the same motel Martin Luther King Jr. stayed in the day he was assassinated. McBride continued to walk aimlessly until he stumbled upon room 306. He peered down and saw blood stains on the cement. Suddenly, he couldn't move. He was paralyzed. He was shaking from the inside, cold. Something had a grip on him. As he stood frozen, vivid ghostly images began appearing before him. There were images of commotion, of witnesses screaming, of shots fired. And once, quote, it released its grip on McBride, he left quickly to the bus station. He saw a stack of newspapers and noticed the date, April 4th, 1988. It was the 20th anniversary of King's assassination. So that's what they say on this website. The thing about him walking aimlessly, that has a lot of significance. As we've shared before, there are five personalities: judge, visionary, conqueror, server, and organizer. Five human personalities. And the visionary personality is the one that is most prone to doing things like this. Walking around, or, you know, going about something, not knowing where it will start or where it will end. Just allowing him or herself to be led, and somehow they find where they are supposed to go. it's not organized. The organizer is the opposite of the visionary in that sense. The organizer has to plan everything. You know, first we're going to go here, then we're going to go here, then we're going to go here, do this, do that, do the other. The visionary is almost the kind of like the antithesis of the organizer. The visionary is willing to go off script and just see where things take them, instead of just following this very rigid and strict organized script. The organization is geared towards efficiency. The organizers aim for efficiency. They hate wasting time. That's why they love to plan things, because when you plan things, you can, you know, you can be very precise and exact and not waste any resources. When you don't organize, there's this danger of wasting resources. And the organizer is so caught up, can get so caught up in efficiency that it kind of starts to stifle or smother the visionary personality, because the visionary is just willing to just see what happens. And that's how visionaries achieve what, you know, what they can achieve. It's through that willingness to not worry about efficiency, not worry about planning and organizing, but about just finding a purpose. The visionary is the seeker of a purpose. And sometimes the organizer can stifle that purpose because of their obsession with efficiency and organization. The thing is that this man decided to go for a walk with no destination in mind, and that's how he ended up at the Lorraine Motel without planning it. And he ended up walking, and he literally arrived at room 306, the same room that turned out to be the place in front of which Martin Luther King was assassinated. I think he walked outside, he walked out of the room, or he was in front of that room outside on this like open hallway. I don't know how to describe it. But the thing is that he was, or outdoor hallway. I really don't know what the term is for that. But the thing is that he was outside of his room and someone shot him. And this Chai McBride was standing right there. He was led to that specific room, and he saw the blood. I don't know if he just visualized it or if it was literally there, this kind of like blood stain on the ground, on the floor, as if, you know, someone had been you know, had bled in that very same spot. The thing is that he went through this experience, and he, as he was describing it, he was saying that he was feeling the impression of everything that happened that day and the sacrifice that Martin Luther King had made that day, you know, when he lost his life. And he saw the commotion as if he was living that very moment. And the fact that he was paralyzed, it was as if he was experiencing what maybe Martin Luther King was physically experiencing, you know, when the bullet hit him and he was maybe paralyzed and couldn't do anything, and he was dying. The thing is that he felt the weight of that moment. And he said that he realized, you know, what Martin Luther King and other people had sacrificed so much so that future generations could have an opportunity to live the dream. And the interesting thing is that when he was describing it, he was saying what Martin Luther King sacrificed was so that Americans could have an opportunity, more Americans could have an opportunity to fulfill their dream or something. But he didn't say black people, he said Americans, which drew my attention. He saw that it was wider than just a black thing. And he said that he was so moved by that experience of feeling the sacrifice that had been done so that he could have an opportunity, a greater opportunity, that he said, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to do something with my life, and so that what all these people did before me will not be for naught. And I think that was one of the drivers of him, you know, trying to pursue a career and be as successful as he has been. So I wanted to share that because when I heard his story, it reminded me of everything we've been saying in these audio snippets, that Black America, the current generation or the later generations don't understand the sacrifices that were made by their ancestors. And not just Martin Luther King, but I'm going way further back into the times of slavery when these their ancestors were dragged from Africa and moved and brought here to the Americas, and we've explained, you know, the reasons behind that, but we're not going to go into all of that again. But the thing is that they were dragged here to make a forcible sacrifice. They were not fulfilling their visionary callings. It's as if they were dragged here to force them to fulfill that sacrificial calling, and they suffered, and they went through all this torture and heartache, and then eventually they were set free, and eventually they experienced a greater level of freedom in the 1960s when the civil rights movement happened and all of that. So all of that sacrifice was so that these generations could be born in America and have opportunities that they could have never had these sacrifices not been made. If they had been born in Africa, if they had never been dragged from Africa to the Americas, they would have never had the opportunities to succeed and thrive the way they have here in Americas. So it's as if all these ancestors paid a sacrificial price, so that. And even if it was forcible, but it was a sacrifice that was made so that these future generations could have opportunities. I mean, think about all the people who want to come illegally into the country, and Black Americans are born into this opportunity. And other people who come with less resources, less stuff, seem to thrive much more than many Black people do. So they don't realize what sacrifices were made, and they're wasting the opportunity that has been given to them. They don't understand that sacrifice. They don't value it. And Chai McBride on that day kind of realized, oh, wow, people have paid a price so that I can have an opportunity to do something with my life. I'm not going to waste that. I'm not going to dishonor the sacrifice. And that talks about the idea of accountability and purpose. And those are two very important things that we want to talk about: accountability and purpose. He felt a sense of accountability, like, I will be accountable for what I do with my life because other people have paid a price that I can have this opportunity. And if I don't do something with my life, I will be held accountable for it. He felt a sense of accountability. And then he was also driven by a sense of purpose. So I am going to fulfill my purpose. So he was inspired, in a sense, by this vision or experience that he had to fulfill a purpose. And those two things, accountability and purpose, are tied to the first two personalities that we always list out, judge and visionary. The judge personality is the one that's always thinking about accountability. It's the one that's always holding themselves and others accountable for things because they're always judging. You know, you should do this, you should not do that, you should do the other. So they're always judging. And that's good. I mean, you have to have people who are judging, and you yourself have to have a judgment nature, because if you don't judge, then you don't recognize what's good, what's evil, and then your life just goes into chaos. So the thing is that the concept of accountability is when you allow that concept comes from allowing the judge personality to flourish. And that's one thing that liberals, especially white liberals, don't like to do. They don't like that accountability of right and wrong, and saying what needs to be said when it needs to be said, because kind of destroys their agenda, their ideology, or their purposes, or their evil purposes. They don't want black people to feel accountable for their own actions, because that throws off their agenda. They don't like people saying this is right, this is wrong. They want to blur everything. And the weird thing is they replace a set of rights and wrongs with another set of rights and wrongs that are all quirky and distorted. And then they enforce those with brutality. They create these mandates, you're going to do this and you're going to tell me what your pronoun is or else, or you are going to accept certain types of sexual behavior, whether you like it or not. And they start imposing these other sets of rules, but they first have to destroy the basic judgments that people make, the righteous judgments that people make. They have to destroy all those, dismantle them, and replace them with a new set of useless and metaphysically unsustainable rules and limitations. But the thing is, they don't like accountability, because they want to see what they don't like about the judgment. They don't like is when you feel accountable to an objective truth. Because you know why they don't like that? Because they can't control the truth. You know, if it's not raining outside, it's not raining outside. I mean, you can't make it rain. Maybe if you believe in rain dances, you can go around and start, you know, doing some sort of rain dances, bring the rain. But even as you're doing the rain dance, it's still not raining until it starts raining. You can't change reality, in the sense of what is. I mean, you can change reality in the future, but what is and what isn't isn't. And so there's a certain kind of lack of control that white liberals, and I say white liberals because they are the ones behind that ideology. They are the masterminds of that. Of all that evil thinking. These white liberals don't like the truth to be holding people accountable, this objective independent truth, because they have no control over the truth. They can't manipulate the truth. So, but they like accountability to them and to the ideologies or whatever things that they fashion and design. They want loyalty to a entity, to a human entity or a human corporation or a human organization. That's what they demand. That's when they become harsh and judgmental, and then they start imposing the stupid sense of accountability, like in those back in when everybody was wearing the stupid face diapers, and if you don't wear the diaper, then you're evil, and we're gonna shun you, and we're gonna ostracize you. And we all know the face diaper was medically useless. It's scientifically established. We've gone through that before. Even Tony Fauci was saying that masks are useless until the politicians got to him and convinced him to start changing his tune. Everybody knows the masks don't work. But no, they started. But why were they imposing the face nappy? Because that was a way of getting people to submit to them, to the government, to the elites, to the liberal rulers. So it was loyalty to them, not to the truth, but to them, not to science, not to facts, not to medical reality, but to them. And that's what they demand, accountability to them and their capricious decrees. But when we're talking about the real accountability, it's accountability to an objective truth that you cannot control. You cannot force something good into being evil, or something evil into being good. If it's good, it's good. If it's evil, it's evil. But you know, that's why liberals always like to do the mind bending thing, where okay, a man can be a woman, a man can be pregnant, a man, all these weird things that they start kind of conjuring up, because they like to shape truth into whatever the hell they want it to be. And once they decide on something, then they force everybody to adjust to this mythical truth, metaphysically unfounded truth. It's a very twisted form of accountability, but not the real one. So we're talking about the real form of accountability and purpose. Visionaries are always driven by a vision, a purpose, something that inspires them and moves them forward towards something. And the visionaries are the ones who are most aware of emptiness. Like, they feel this emptiness that, you know, oh, my life has no purpose. So I need to understand what my purpose is for, or what my life is for, what my purpose is. So accountability is associated to the judge personality, and purpose is associated to the visionary personality. And those two things are important. And this actor, Chai McBride, kind of experienced both things at that very moment. He felt a sense of accountability about his life. And then he said, I am going to seek a purpose. I'm not just going to float around in this world doing nothing. And even when he was, like, in a sense, literally floating around that day, you know, walking, quote, aimlessly through Memphis, it was not really aimlessly, in the sense that there was a purpose. So because he ended up being at that Lorraine Motel and having that, very unusual experience. So the visionary is always this driven by this idea of, oh, I have to fill the void. There's something missing. I have to find it and pursue that purpose. And that's one thing that the liberals like to take advantage of. They like to take that sense of emptiness and fill it with false causes and false visions. And that's why they say, oh, we have to save the planet, save the whales, you know, save Britney. Save Britney, that's a different thing. I have no idea what to think about all of that. But the thing is that when you're a visionary, you feel a need to live for a cause or something, and the liberal starts injecting all these artificial things. Climate change, the world is going to die, and all the polar bears are floating on these little ice chunks that are floating because all the ice is melting. Oh my goodness, the horror. And then they start creating all these artificial causes that are not founded on reality. Remember ClimateGate, the thing that happened in the UK with, I think, the Imperial College and the lie about the hockey stick graph and all that. Some of you may know what I'm talking about. These are all fabrications because they're not based on scientific truth. They're just based on ideology. And I think we shared in a previous audio snippet that one time I was watching a show called Heart Talk. Yeah, I think that was the name of the show. It's a British show. And it was in around 2004, 2005, or a little bit later. And there was this fellow who was interviewing a guy who was involved in this ClimateGate scandal. And he asked him, why did you lie? You're a scientist. Why did you lie about the hockey stick graph? And then he said, well, sometimes we need to lie because that's how you get the message across. You have to exaggerate the truth a bit to get people aware and drive them to do what needs to be done to save the world or whatever. So that's how they think. You know, they have a truth that has nothing to do with the real truth, fictional truth, and then they do whatever it takes to get people to pursue that truth or that cause. And they're willing to lie to make, and they justify it in their heads. And even a scientist who's supposed to be the most objective and most a person who is not following ideologies or superstitious, but following the facts. When you're a liberal, that all of that goes away. So the thing is that liberals like to fill that void that visionaries feel with all these false causes. Oh, let's feed the poor, and let's do all these things, and there's nothing wrong with feeding the poor. But what I'm saying is that they fill them with these sometimes false causes and sometimes superficial causes, where you just deal with the surface issues and don't deal with the root issues. Yeah, you go feed all these people in Africa when they're starving, but they're always starving, and no one sits down and wonders, well, what? Pardon my French, but what the hell is going on? Why do we have to go feed these people in Africa all the time, and they're always starving, and we always have to go feed them? What's going on behind the surface? They've been independent for so many decades. They're their own countries, and they are killing each other and starving, and their economies are not growing. And instead of dealing with the root issues and confronting with the righteous or unrighteous roots, the unrighteous roots behind the problems, they just want to do the surface thing. And that gives them a sense of fulfillment. Oh, yes, I went to feed one kid for one day. Oh, you know, whoop-de-doo. Then when you leave, the kid's going to be starving again, because the root problem in his society has not been dealt with. So what good did you do? You just helped for one day. Yeah, it's good to help for one day if that's like a temporary holdover while you fix the real problem. It's like if someone's house is falling apart and they need a place to stay, well, you give them room to live in your house. But then you have to find a way to fix their house so they can move back into their house. And these people just, you know, they give you room to stay, but in a temporary house, but they never fix the permanent house. The thing is that the liberals are always trying to fill that emptiness in visionaries with these false, sometimes outright false causes, and sometimes causes that are superficially true but do not deal with the root issues. And once you have the visionary, the accountability, the judgment accountability, and the visionary purpose set, that's like the foundation. Once you set those two things, then you go on to the third thing, which is the third personality, which is the personality of conqueror. Then you can go out to conquer. And those three personalities form what we have described as the male personalities. And we're not talking about physical male or physical female, literal biological male female. And we're talking about, you know, in a figurative sense, those three form the male personality. A conqueror who does not have accountability, judgment accountability, or a visionary purpose is going to be a failure. If you're a conqueror, you can conquer, but if you don't have accountability in place as a foundation, then yeah, whatever you conquer is just going to be chaos, because accountability creates laws. It creates boundaries, limitations. It says you can do this, you cannot do that. It creates order in a certain sense. And that's why, for example, black people who come out of the ghetto, let's say, and they are great athletes and they become professional superstars and make millions and millions of dollars, and they end up, you know, wasting their money in all this orgies and all this wasteful spending on cars and bling bling here and bling bling there and all that. They start spending all that money, and then they end up with nothing at the end, and they do drugs and they do all these things because they have no accountability. They have no sense of judgment. This is right, this is wrong. So yes, they did conquer a lot of money, come into a lot of money, but it all goes into chaos and then dissipates and becomes nothing. So that's what happens when you have a conqueror with no accountability. And you can also have a conqueror with no purpose. So it's like you conquer something, and let's say there's some people, for example, and this is more on the white side of the world, you could say, that these people who are very driven to succeed in business, and they start a company and they make all this money and they acquire another company and they become the leaders in their industry or whatever. And they do all these things. They have their big mansion, and these people do have accountability in the sense of, you know, right and wrong and all that, but they don't have a purpose. So they make all this money, and then they sit there, you know, at age 50 or whatever, and they look at their empire, look around, and they know they're empty on the inside. They're totally empty. They have no, it's like, what did I do this for? Okay, I'm the biggest person in my field. I'm a big success. I have all this money, all these houses, all these cars, but what's the purpose? And they know it's, they know it. They know there's an emptiness there because they conquered without purpose. And by the way, many liberals who are into that, they try to fill that purpose with all these banal causes. Oh, I'm going to donate to this charity, or I'm going to march the March for AIDS, and I'm going to go there and walk, and or I'm going to do this, that, the other. All these banal causes, trying to fill that void, as if to say, yes, I am going to give an artificial purpose to the conquest I have made. All this money is going to serve this I'm going to artificially make it relevant for something, but it's just surface stuff, and the void inside, that deep void remains. And what we do as human beings a lot of the time is when we have that void, we try to fill it with temporary things, you know, like we try to distract our minds with so many things and so many activities and so many other things to try to not hear that void on the inside. This is it. That's why some people hate to be alone or hate to be in a silent place, because when you're in a silent place, you're forced to hear your own thoughts. And to some people, that can be terrifying, because you're sitting there and it's like, just that's when you become aware of the emptiness, and you realize, oh my goodness, what was the purpose of my life? What was I here for? Let me binge on whatever show, and they start doing whatever it takes to not hear that horrible, horrible silence inside that reveals the emptiness, the lack of purpose of their lives. So you have to have accountability and a purpose, an accountability that's based on judgment, on the judgment personality. You have to have a purpose based on the visionary personality. And once you have those two as a foundation, then you go out as a conqueror and you start achieving things. And because you have a solid foundation of accountability and purpose, whatever you conquer will be permanent and will have a lasting effect. So these are part of the reasons why we wanted to mention this story about Chai McBride and what happened to him. And it's also interesting that, you know, it all happened in 1988 on April 4th, 20 years after Martin Luther King's assassination. And it's relevant in the sense because if you go to the website where we post these audio clips, we mention these are posts from literally 12 years ago or less, I'm not sure. But the thing is that we did at some point talk about April 4th as a very important date. If you look up a post on that website where we post these audio clips, and you look up the a post called Eagle Down, if I'm not mistaken, and you do a search for April 4th inside that post, you will see what we said about April 4th. Yeah, and Eagle Down talks about something that happened with, I think, two eagles that went down one day. I forget what that post was about, but it was almost like we were talking about the future downfall of America related to April 4th. And then in another post around the same time, that's called Bearers Absent, bears presence. Bearers, as in someone who bears something, who carries something. Bearers absent, and bears, as in the animal. Bears present, part two. There's a section called April 4th Rift, and we talk about how on April 4th, 2010, it's as if something happened in America, as if the truth was upset with this country and said, I am tired of you. And I think that was the beginning of like a final phase of something with the country. And now we are on our way to dying, like around, I guess, 6 months from now, officially dying. So I think it's all related. You know, this person who had this actor, the Chai McBride, who had this experience on an April 4th. And April 4th is a very relevant date for America. And I think that's why Martin Luther King was assassinated on that day. It's the day of the end of a dream of someone who did not fulfill his purpose, who only went halfway. Because Martin Luther King did a lot, but he did not complete his plan or what he was supposed to do. He only did half of it, and because he refused to do the other half, we are still paying the consequences. If he had completed the whole thing, the country would be very different, and who knows? Maybe we might still have hope. Who knows? But he refused to do it, and that's why he was taken down that day. And he knew he was going down, because shortly before that, you know, the mountaintop speech, it's like he knew he was about to die. But the reason why he was about to die was because he refused to fulfill the fullness of his calling. And if he had survived or lived on, he would have completely destroyed his legacy. Because then he would have deformed or into a very nasty left-wing liberal. And you can see the legacy of the people he left behind, like John Lewis, all these people who followed him closely. You would have thought that these men would be men infused with like the same character and integrity or whatever that people ascribe to Martin Luther King. But you know, John Lewis has been this horrible, horrible, evil man. He once lied about someone spitting in his face, because he wanted, you know, he's you know, the rabble rousers, those who like to use race as a way to incite people. So he claimed that some white guy spat on him, and then it turned out to be a lie and things like that. People of no character, no real integrity. So the thing is that now we would like to share the second thing we wanted to talk about that seems completely unrelated, but I hope you'll see that there is a connection. It's a story that came out, very recently. It's a story on the Gateway Pundit, and the title of it is Beyond Parody. The IRS reminds thieves that they have to pay taxes on stolen property. And you have to laugh when you read that. My goodness. And this is not like an exaggeration or a right-wing conspiracy story. this is literally the truth. Let me see if I can find, they have a screenshot of a Twitter tweet or whatever it's called. And someone wrote, remember, the IRS requires you to report all income from illegal activities. And they have like a screenshot within the tweet of the IRS website. And I'm going to read what it says on the IRS website. According to the screenshot, it says illegal activities. Income from illegal activities such as money from dealing illegal drugs must be included in your income on Schedule 1, Form 1040, Line 8Z, or on Schedule C, Form 1040, if from your self-employment activity. In other words, if you're self-employed as a drug dealer, then you have to use Schedule C, Form 1040. But if you work for a crime organization, then you have to use Schedule 1 Form 1040 line and use and go to line 8Z. I mean, how much more ridiculous can you get? It's like, say, if you're they're so specific about what form to use, what line to do it in. Then it says stolen property. If you steal property, I'm sorry. If you steal property, you must report its fair market value in your income in the year you steal it. In the year you steal it, forget. You have to remember, if you stole it in 2022, you have to report it in your tax return for 2022. Please remember that. Unless you return it to its rightful owner in the same year. So that kind of leaves a dilemma. If I steal something in the year 2022, okay, I steal $20,000 or I steal a watch, I steal a car from someone in 2022, and now it's 2023, I have to, you know, file my income tax, return for 2022, and I have to report the stolen car as income. But what if I already returned it to the owner because I had a conscience or whatever, and I just went and parked it in front of the guy's house and ran away and said, okay, you know, sorry, here's your car back. But now I returned it, but because I stole it in 2022, I have to report its income for 2022, even though I've returned it in 2023. So it's like, my goodness, if the year ends and I've stolen the property, this is kind of an incentive not to return whatever I stole, because I'm going to have to pay taxes on it, you know? This is just the most stupid thing. Like, if you read the paragraph, you know, you're reading a government website. If you start a paragraph or a sentence with, if you steal property, I mean, comma, you would expect that the rest of the sentence would say, you should return the property and to its owner, and turn yourself into the authorities, and we will, you know, be lenient with you or whatever. It's like, if you steal property, you must report it. It's fair market value. And then I forget where I read it, but I think it says also on their website that they emphasize, the IRS purportedly uses the information solely for tax purposes and does not hand over any evidence to law enforcement. The only situation where law enforcement may have access to the information is through court orders. So this is ridiculous. You know, the IRS is saying, "Oh, we're not going to tell the rest of the government, you know, what you did. This is just for tax purposes. But please, you know, part of the reason why I'm sharing this is, you know, first of all, to show the stupidity of these people. One thing that I've noticed with liberals, especially white liberals, is, you know, that how demanding they are about people paying their taxes, especially if you're white and wealthy, you have to pay your fair share. And how dare you? That's your patriotic duty. You have to pay taxes. This obsession, you know, pay your taxes, because it funds there. And why they demand this accountability? Again, it's always accountability to an organization or to a group of people. It's never to the truth. It's to a group of people, because they need all this money to continue coming in. It's a sign of submission. They don't see it as a sign of, okay, you have to fulfill your obligations, whatever. They don't see it as a moral duty. They, at the end, if you untangle all the surface, what you will find is, no, they are doing it because they want you to bend the knee and prove that you are willing to do whatever they tell you to do, so that they can do whatever they want to do. It's not an accountability to the truth. And that's why I remember one time I was watching this story many years ago. This reporter from Fox News, when Fox News was more or less an acceptable or bearable station to watch, he went to this Democrat fellow who was, you know, demanding that taxes be raised on the rich, And he went to the guy and said, "Hey, there's a website, a government website, where you can go and donate money to the government." And I believe that's the case. I mean, if you're that stupid and you want to give money away to the government, there is a website where you can go and say, "I want to give more of my money to you, $10,000 or whatever." So this reporter went and said to the Democrat, "Hey, this liberal, white liberal piece of worthless trash." And he said to him, hey, there's this website. You're saying that the rich should pay more. You have some money, right? So why don't you go to the website and donate and prove with your actions that you really mean it when you say that people should fulfill their duty of paying their taxes." And the guy was, the Democrat was so like, "Oh, I don't want to talk about it. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that." And he was walking away trying to avoid the guy. And that shows their hypocrisy. It's not that they don't demand taxes because they feel the duty, the moral duty of helping. It's not that, because their accountability is not attached to an objective truth. Because if it was attached to an objective truth, it wouldn't matter if the government is forcing me or not forcing me to give away the money. I would give it. If I feel the moral duty, I would be giving it away. But they don't, because no. It's because the higher tax is just to prove that you are submitting to them, that you are going to bend the knee in their presence and do whatever they tell you to do. That's one aspect of it. The IRS is, you know, now that's even more controlled by liberals and white liberals. They have this increasing obsession we don't care where the money's from. We just want you to give us more money. And that's why they go even to this moral extreme. That's why we're saying accountability, not to an objective truth, but to them. That's why they're saying, "I don't care if you stole it, but we don't care if you did something that's against the objective truth, moral truth, ethical truth. We don't care, just as long as you report the income to us. That's all we care about." So that tells you there's not an accountability towards the truth, because, you know, stealing is wrong, drug crime is wrong, bribery is wrong, because you have to report. If you bribe someone, you have to report that as income too. That's part of the whole thing. Let's say you engage in kidnapping or something, and you got some your ransom money. You have to report that as income. So that's the thing, is it doesn't matter if it's morally deplorable. There is no accountability to an objective moral truth, objective external truth. It's accountability to them. That's what they demand. So that's one aspect of it. And the IRS has always, you know, is known as the most brutal collection agency on the face of the earth. If you don't pay your taxes, they come brutally against you. And there's a certain brutal hypocrisy in that, because the government, the U.S. government, is ruthless in going after people. And that's one thing. Like, for example, even if you say the hell with America and you go live somewhere else and you're an American, even as an American living abroad, making money abroad, not having anything to do with America anymore, you still have to pay taxes to America. Even if you're living in Italy or France or wherever you want to go, the American government reaches its tentacles all the way across the pond and still demands to get your money from you. And that's why a lot of Americans, when they decide they don't want to live in America anymore, when they leave, they renounce their citizenship. Because it's a way of finally cutting off that oppression of the IRS, the tentacles of the IRS reaching into their pockets all the way across the world. So it's a brutal agency and ruthless. If you don't pay taxes, I mean, you go to jail. I mean, they are vicious. They freeze your assets. I forget the term for it, but when they freeze your bank accounts and you can't do you can't use your own money anymore, and they destroy. They're willing to destroy your life until you pay what you owe them, until you give them, their pound of flesh. But at the same time, the same government that's so ruthless and so merciless. And the ironic thing about this is that these are, most of these are Democrats. And they always talk about mercy and compassion, but they show no compassion when it comes to these taxes. And most of the time, when the people who can't pay taxes are generally the people who are poor, who are middle to lower income, they are the ones who are less prone to, or more prone to not paying, or more susceptible to not paying their taxes, and or small businesses. And they go after them with no sense of mercy. So all that talk about, oh yeah, we care for the poor and compassion, and yeah, we just want to milk the rich to give to the poor, the Robin Hood thing, it all goes away. And the people who are hurt the most are middle to lower income people by the ruthlessness of the IRS when they go after them, after people who don't pay. Because the rich have money to throw, to spend, you know, so they don't mind giving away a certain amount of money because they're already rich. But the hypocrisy is that just as they're being ruthless in demanding money, they are very lax when it comes to spending the money they get from us. So that's why we have this constant increase in the debt limit. And I saw this thing, this comment that someone made recently that just irritated me to no end. This person was talking about, you know, if they don't increase the debt limit, America's going to default on its payments for the first time in history, and how horrible that is, making it sound like it's the moral duty of Congress to raise the debt limit for the umpteenth time so that we can fulfill our payment obligations. So borrow more money, get more into debt. And they have no problem with increasing the debt and wasting the money on so many useless things. And there is no accountability. So they demand accountability against you to pay taxes, and they are ruthless about it, but they have no accountability on how they spend the money that is given to them. And because, see, the thing is, if you owe the IRS, you can't say to the IRS, oh, can you raise my debt limit? How much do I owe you? I owe you $50,000. Can you raise my debt limit to $60,000? Because I'm going to owe you $10,000 this year, too. You know, if you go and say that to the IRS, they're going to laugh, you know, they're going to laugh their heads off and then handcuff you and throw you in jail. Yeah, they're not going to say, oh, yes, Your Highness. Yes, we're going to raise your limit to $60,000. Next year, you're not going to pay $20,000 in taxes. So we're going to raise it to $80,000 next year. And don't worry, sir. Yeah, you're going to have to pay some interest on this because this is more of a loan that we're handing out to you in a sense. But as long as you keep up with the interest payments, it's fine. And if you don't have money for the interest payments, just add it to the tab. You know, just increase, we'll increase the debt limit as much as you. That's what they're doing. So we can't do it to them, but they do it to us. And the thing is that, you know, increasing the debt limit is so easy for a politician because it's not their money, it's other people's money. And that's why one of the things, we have talked in earlier audio snippets about how, you know, the new American Constitution would have embedded in it the concept of debt control and no and balanced budgets. And we explain how if in any given year the country went into debt, that would trigger an automatic penalty in the salaries of all government employees, especially the people in Congress, Their salaries would be decreased and they would be penalized for the rest of their lives as long as the debt they incurred remains in the books. So even if they retired and went to live, you know, put their post-Congress life at home, they would still be forced to pay a penalty for every year that that debt that they incurred in that year continues to be in the books. So if they incurred a $10 billion debt, there would be a proportional formula and they would have to pay a significant amount of their money for the rest of their lives as a punishment for having wasted the people's money that way. And believe you me, you do that and all those, you know, calls to increase the debt limit would go to hell. I mean, they would burn them in the New York Minute, like they would never want to hear about anything like that again, because they know that now it's their money at stake. So that would be one of the things. But because that would require a constitutional change. In the meantime, what these politicians could do, I mean, these people have no vision, nothing. They have no, these people are morons because they're conquerors without a purpose, these politicians, especially the Republicans. Couldn't they just come up, okay, the Democrats always use this thing about, oh, they use the political football of the debt limit and always say, well, if the Republicans oppose the increase in the debt limit, it's because they don't want the government pension checks to go out because they're so evil and greedy and they don't care about the poor. So they start playing this political, you know, they take out the, you know, the Democrats always have this violence section. And whenever they want to, they need it, they, you know, they snap a finger and then all the violence start playing and they start, you know, telling all these sad stories about all these things that will happen because the Republicans are evil and all that. And the Republicans should say, okay, to stop all this football, political football game, they should say, you know what? This is the people's money. It's not our money. It's the people's money. So why don't we do this? Why don't we, should propose a bill that says that the debt limit can only be increased by popular vote. In other words, it should be a referendum. Every time they need to increase the debt limit, they should put a national referendum and say to people, do you want us to get into more debt? Do you want your children to have to carry a larger burden of debt? Do you want to increase the chances of a future financial collapse of the American economy for the sake of you know, dealing with short-term issues? Or do you really want us to start cutting costs and cutting spending and cutting all the waste? What do you want? Do you want to increase the debt limit or not? And I can assure you things would be very different. Then there would be no way of playing political football. And the Republicans could say, well, if you're thought about, if you think that we are opposing the people's will when it comes to not increasing the debt limit, then why are you afraid of a referendum if it's the people's will? Because the majority of Americans, as you always claim, are poor and oppressed by the rich people. And the rich people is this 1%, the 1% oppressing the 99%. So if that's the case, when you think that 99% of the people would be happy with an increase in the debt limit as per your arguments and your ideology, so there'd be only a very few number of people who would be opposed to increasing the debt limit as per your ideology. So why would you be afraid of a referendum if everything you're saying is true? See how they could play it right back? And it's not just a playing, and we're not talking about sophistry here. You know, sophistry in the old days was this Greek thing in the old ancient Greek days where people who learn to win arguments just for the sake of winning arguments, like playing word games and manipulating so that they could win. But it was not a question of being right. It was just a question of how to win the debate. You know, what techniques can I apply to win the debate? So this may sound like sophistry, but no, it's more than sophistry. It is actually a confrontation of ideas to expose the inconsistency. That's one thing we've been saying recently. Truth is based on consistency. If you're living by truth, when you live by the truth, there's a consistency to it that you don't contradict yourself. And people who are mathematicians know that if you have a mathematical model, if you build a mathematical model that is sound, then you will never have it contradict itself. Like one technique that mathematicians use, because I was a maths major at university in college. But the thing is that one technique that's used in mathematics to prove a theorem is to assume it's false. So if you want to prove something is true, what you do sometimes is assume it's false and see the consequences of assuming that is false. And usually the proof consists in a logical sequence that leads to a contradiction to something that is, for example, you end up concluding that 1 must be equal to 2. And you know 1 cannot be equal to 2, hence your initial assumption is wrong. So your initial assumption was this was false, hence it's true. That's what they call proof by contradiction. You assume it's false, and that will lead to an inconsistency where you end up having to accept that 1 is equal to 2, which is impossible. So so truth is consistent. And what we're doing here is through wisdom attacking the falsehoods and finding how and exposing how inconsistent their thinking is and their ideology and their philosophy. But it requires having a little bit of like a visionary attitude. And these Republicans don't have any of that. They could be doing that right now, and we could start stopping the nonsense. And one thing I would say is, you know what? And in order to not have to increase the debt limit, we're going to demand that no one in Congress makes more than $90,000 a year, no staffer, no nobody, and you can hear the uproar. And can you imagine the embarrassment? How embarrassed the Democrats would feel in having to say, no, we need our, no, we can't make more less than 90,000. How dare you? After all the talk about how the rich and the poor and all that, imagine. Oh no, then they would be exposing themselves as people who like being rich, who talk trash about the rich, but they like being rich themselves. So, you know, but that's never going to happen, especially because America's going to die. So we want to talk about the hypocrisy of how the IRS, the government, is so merciless at going after people, the American government, going after people for to get their taxes, and even willing to say, even if you got your money from illegal activity, you have to declare it because we need the tax money. But at the same time, they are so lax in their way, the way they spend their money, and they do things that they would never allow us to do. As we said, we would never be allowed to increase our debt limit with the IRS and get away with it. No, we'd end up in jail. But that goes to a kind of a different or related topic that we wanted to mention here. And it has to do with property theft. And maybe we have talked about this before. I do not recall, to be frank. But one of the things that would have been different in the new American Constitution is that, you know, first of all, the explicit declaration of the right to property, that, as we've said before, it doesn't exist in the American Constitution, the current American Constitution. It's not there. You conservatives, you can say all you want about property rights and all that, but your stupid, useless constitution doesn't say a diddly squat about that right. So every time you talk about right to property and capitalism, you're not talking constitution, you're talking something else, because the constitution doesn't back you up one iota on that topic. And we've said even the 11th Amendment is an anti-property rights amendment, because it declared it's more... The sovereignty of a state is more important than the right to property of the individual. And we've described that ad nauseum before in previous audio snippets. So the Constitution, if anything, is anti-property. The few times it has made an implicit or explicit statement about property, it's been negative. But in the new American Constitution, it would be clearly defined. This is one of the five fundamental human rights, the right to property, and which I would call right number two. It's life, property, privacy, fair reputation, and personal domain. And in this declaration of the right to property, because it's a fundamental human right, whenever it's violated, there is a criminal penalty associated to every right. And that's one thing that is lacking in our current legal system. For example, the right to a fair reputation. If it's violated, the most that you can do is sue for money, like libel, you know, or slander or whatever. You can sue someone and if you win, you get money from them. But the way I see it is, if they ruin your reputation, they should, and it's a valid case you have, and you win, they should go to jail. They should not just pay you money. They should go to jail because they violated a fundamental human right. So the thing is, the right to property would be protected. And whenever the property right is violated, then the person is punishable, by a prison sentence. And that happens in the current system. But the difference would be that whenever someone's right to every time, every violation of a right, that'd be a constitutional principle. Every violation of a right requires a restitution of what was taken. For example, if someone violated the right to a fair reputation of someone else, not they should not only serve time, but also be obligated to rectify the smear that they did on the other person, through a public statement or whatever, to say, no, I recognize that what I did was wrong. And if they're unwilling to do that, then their prison sentence would be extended, because it's not just a matter of, it's like the eye for an eye thing. If you did this, you have to compensate somehow. Now, with the right to property, it would be the same thing. And this, people always complain, and to a certain extent, they are right in doing so, when they complain, oh, the American legal system is so crooked because it's so harsh on the poor people, like all these people who commit petty crimes and shoplift because they are hungry and they need some food, and they're so harsh on them. And then there are all these white-collar people who commit these horrible, billion-dollar crimes and steal all this money, and they get away with a slap on the wrist. And yes, there is a certain truth to that statement. But and the people who believe this, and who always see this as a way to validate this idea that in their heads that capitalism is evil and it's the rich oppressing the poor, they should be happy with this. The idea would be, if you steal $10,000 from someone, you don't get out of jail until you pay back the $10,000 plus a multiplication factor, penalty factor. I don't know exactly what that factor would be, but let's say I would make it four times. Maybe that's not the right number, I don't know, but let's assume it's four times. So if I am found guilty of stealing $10,000 from person A, then I cannot be free, or in other words, I will remain under punishment until I pay back $40,000 to person A, 10,000 times four. So if I stole $1 million, I have to give him back, or give her back, $4 million. If I stole a penny, I have to pay back 4 pennies. If I stole $5, if I shoplifted and stole a $10 item, I have to pay the store $40 back. And until I pay those $40 back, I will remain, maybe in prison or under some sort of penalty. Now, imagine that if you do a white collar crime where you steal $20 billion from all these people and steal their retirement funds and waste it all away, then you don't get out of jail until you pay back $80 billion. And that means that basically a death sentence, and because they're never going to be able to pay back $80 billion. And the reason why that is a valid eye for an eye situation is because a person who steals $20 billion, like the Bernie Madoffs of this world, they destroy the financial future of hundreds of or thousands and thousands of people, people whose lives are destroyed, thousands of people. And they're one life destroying thousands of lives. So they deserve to be punished 1,000-fold because they destroyed the lives of so many people. I hope you see what I'm saying. That's why it's only fair that such a person would never be able to see the light of day ever again because they stole so much money. And that would just that rule alone would just make people think a million times before they steal $1 million, because they know that if they ever get caught, they will be forced, they will be in prison for the rest of their lives until they pay off $4 million back to the people that they stole from. Now, if you're a shoplifter and you shoplift a chocolate sweet or something, then you know maybe you won't think as much because you only will only have to pay back four times as much. But so it's kind of fair in a sense because it doesn't punish the poor and the needy as much as it punishes the rich. So you know the liberals should be happy with that, but I'm sure they would cry to heaven because they know that, you know, they see that, you know, I don't know, I'm just saying a number, I'm not sure exactly what the number is, but 60% of people in jail are black, and, you know, most of theft crimes are committed by black people. They're going to say, oh, it's racism, this and that, the other. So they will never be satisfied with anything that has to do with accountability, real accountability, but that should be the principle there, that property theft should be punished with payment, and that's why the politicians who get us into debt should be punished with their own money for wasting the people's money whilst they are in office. And let's say that you're in jail, and you know, how do you pay it back? Because you're in jail, so. One of the ways is, first of all, if you have the money still stashed around somewhere, you can reduce the debt. And wouldn't that be a way to get people to, like a lot of people, what they do, they steal a lot of money and like the white collar crime, and they put it in offshore funds that are out of reach of the tentacles of the IRS. And once they finish their jail sentence, they go retrieve that money that they stole from people. But if they know that their sentence could be shortened by them paying back, you know, the money, then that'd be a natural incentive to recover as much money as possible that they stole. They'd have to sell off their yachts and whatever they bought with the fraudulent money, and pay it back. So it would be an incentive. But let's say that you are in a situation where you don't have the money, you spent it all on crack or whatever, and now you don't have any skills. So what do you do while you're in jail? In the Constitution would be, maybe not in detail, but at least the principle would be laid out that in prison, you are there to pay back to society what you did, literally and figuratively. If they have a skill, they would have to work. You know, now that working from home is such a popular thing, they'd be working from home, but, you know, home would be their jail cell, and they would have to work and you know, from their work, start paying off the debt to the people that they owe, that they stole from. But even, if, for example, if someone is unskilled, has nothing that they can do from home, quote-unquote, to pay off the debt, then what would be done is to give them artificial work. So, for example, I know this sounds stupid, but it's just to say something. I don't know exactly how it would be materialized, but if they can write, let's say, then you tell them you have to take the Bible, you know, let's say, or whatever book, or, you know, Pride and Prejudice, or, you know, there's a book out there that's always famous for being such a horribly long book. Take a novel like that, and you have to write write by hand, not type it. Write by hand. You know, they would be given all these pieces of paper and a pen, and you have to write Pride and Prejudice, in handwriting, the whole thing, from beginning to end, and we will pay you a certain amount of money for every page that you write. And, you know, and we have to confirm it's your handwriting, you know, it's not you somehow getting someone else to do it for you, to be and they would have to pay it off, and they'd have to sit all day writing, you know, writing everything down. Or let's say they can't read and write, then you have to do drawings, and for every drawing you get a nickel, or I don't know how much money, or a dollar. And you do all these drawings on paper, and they're going to be evaluated, and we're going to pay you for this. And I know it's artificial work. It's, you know, who cares, you know, what they paint or draw, and unless they're actual painters or artists. But it's going to be a way of forcing them to artificially work it off if they don't have an actual skill they can use to actually produce money and pay it off. And I can assure you, theft would just go down in society in a heartbeat, because there'd be this sense of accountability. If I stole $10,000, see, the thing is, when you steal money, you're stealing more than property. You're stealing the person's life, in a sense. This is almost, in a sense, property and life. Those two rights are sometimes, you know, the rights are all kind of interconnected in some way. So when you steal a person's property, you steal a part of their life too, because that money would have been used to buy food to live for another day, and you stole their time, because let's say somebody gets robbed, and they mugged on the street, and they get $800 taken away from them. Those $800 didn't come out of thin air. Let's say that person had to work a week or two to make those $8,000. All that time is stolen. See, that those $800 represent more than just money. It represents time. Those 2 weeks of life that person invested to acquire those $800 are gone, are stolen from them. So there's like a part of their life is taken away from them. So all these people who steal under this new system would become aware of that, would have that sense of accountability, that just like they stole someone else's life and property, they stole their life, part of their time, part of their future. Because if you get your savings stolen, imagine the sense of despair and horror that you feel, how am I going to live the next day? And all of that is, you know, the consequence of the theft. And they would be feeling that accountability. They're writing Pride and Prejudice, you know, writing all these, you know, they're spending time having to write it up to pay off the debt. And the sense of purposelessness, oh, why am I writing this? They'd be feeling the emptiness that they leave in people's lives after they have robbed them and stolen their life savings, or stolen their, you know, salary or their paycheck or whatever. So that would be part of the system. And the thing is, we have maybe mentioned this in very briefly, and we're running out of time. I thought this was going to be much faster. But the prison system should be completely transformed. And that's what would have happened if America had survived under the new American Constitution. The American Constitution would have established the prison system would be a prison system based on isolation. And what do I mean by that? I think we've shared this before, that prison tends to be a place where people go to. It's like Crime U, University of Criminal Activities, because people, you know, some people are petty criminals, and then they go to jail, and then they start mingling with all these hardened, lifelong criminals. And they not only get an impartation of the attitude, that, you know, that thuggery and all that evil, conniving attitude, but they also learn techniques, because they start hearing, you know, learning from all these hardened criminals on how to commit crimes, higher level crimes. So they come out of jail, you know, practically having received an education on how to commit crimes, and they go out and continue their life of crime. So, and there's this perpetual, you know, revolving door. They go in and out, go in and out, go in and out, because the prison system doesn't do anything. You say, oh yeah, that's why we have to focus on reform. You know how you do reform? You put someone in a room and leave them to themselves. And it goes to what we were saying at the beginning. They will be in that room, and I believe it should be individuals, not you know, bunking with someone else, you know, cellmates and stuff. Just these tiny rooms with the toilet and a table and a chair and a very hard bed and nothing else, you know, and maybe obviously the bed coverings and all that, but a very basic layout, and you'd be there all day. And it'd be also where you could shower. So it'd be like so we have to invest in buildings like that, just these small rooms, tiny rooms, and you go in there and that's all you have. Imagine the torment that goes into a person's soul when they're all by themselves, especially a criminal who has no purpose, no sense of guidance of anything. And they're there by themselves, and they look at their four walls and see, this is my life. What am I doing with my life? And they have to hear themselves. And then we can have reduced sentences. Because you send someone for 20 years, and, you know, all these people, when I hear on television, you know, when they talk about, they did a deal with the DA, so that the DA would take out the death penalty, and so they decide to confess so that they don't get the death penalty, but they get life without parole. And I go, my goodness, if I know I'm going to be in jail for all my life without parole, possibility of getting out, why do I want to even live anymore? You know, to be in this hopeless situation in jail. You know why they don't mind? Because they get entertained in jail. They get to live. They get out on the courtyard and play basketball and talk to other criminals. It's like they're kind of living this limited existence, but they're still living. So that's why there's no reform. So they can go for years without changing, and it's a useless, relatively useless to give them such long sentences. But if we had the system of isolation, we can reduce like a 10-year sentence to 9 months. Imagine 9 months of just being by yourself. And all you're fed the food every day and everything, but you don't get out. And if you want to do exercise, you can do push-ups. You can do whatever, you know, you don't have to go to the prison gym. And I know that a lot of the prisoners would start going, because that's a technique they use when they are sent to isolation. They start acting crazy and banging themselves against the wall, their heads against the wall, because they know that that's the way to get out of isolation. So if they want to do that, let them do it. They're gonna go crazy. Well, let them go crazy. But sometimes that will be the breaking point for them to change their lives. And you can provide, you know, minimal things. Like a newspaper or things like that, that they can read, books or whatever. But you would be forcing them to be by themselves, to be alone. And 8 months of isolation would do the job that 20 years in Sing Sing would do nowadays. So we could reduce sentences. We would have to spend less, because we wouldn't have to be, you know, paying for the gym equipment and all these other amenities, and no cafeteria and, you know, none of that. It would be very straightforward. And this reminds me, and I know we're way over, but I want to say this, and it's very important to, even if this audio snippet becomes very long, I hope not, but we need to say this. When I was thinking about this, you know, prison and isolation, the phrase that came to me is isolation, that it's not good for me. And the reason, and that song, and that came from a song, and the name of the song is called Lemon Tree. It's a 1995 song by a German group called Fool's Garden. And I wanted to read the lyrics of the song, and I hope you see, as I'm reading this, I hope you can imagine, like, someone sitting in their jail cell by themselves. Now, this song was written apparently, from what I read on Wikipedia, I found out it was written by this German fellow because he was, one Sunday afternoon, he was waiting for his girlfriend to show up at his house, I think, I don't know, but she never showed. So that inspired this song. Now, think of this, and there are two ways to think of this. One is the jail, the guy in jail, in that isolation cell that we, that we're talking about. And there's another context, but let's first think of it in that context of the prison guy. It says, I'm sitting here in the boring room. And it's interesting how he said it. I'm sitting here in the boring room. It's like almost as if he knew we would be talking about this in terms of jail. I don't know. It is so strange to me. But I'm sitting here in the boring room. It's just another rainy Sunday afternoon. I'm wasting my time. I got nothing to do. I'm hanging around. I'm waiting for you. But nothing ever happens. And I wonder. So it's so this guy is, you know, got nothing to do. That emptiness when you you're forced to listen to your own self, and you're aware of the emptiness. Imagine that prisoner in that prison cell saying this to himself. I've got nothing to do. It's like my life has no purpose. Like that's what it goes back to what we were saying about Chai McBride. He became aware at that moment, I need to have a purpose in my life. I cannot just drift aimlessly through life. And he almost said it in those words when he was describing it on that TV show, describing the experience. He said, I realize I cannot just go through life expecting for things to come to me. I have to go after them. So then the song says, I'm driving around in my car. I'm driving too fast, I'm driving too far. I'd like to change my point of view. I feel so lonely, I'm waiting for you, but nothing ever happens, and I wonder. So when he says I'm driving around in my car, it's like people who try to fill that void with a lot of activities. So they get into these cars, the cars are a figure of like methodologies and things that you get into, traditions and habits. And I'm driving too fast, like you just try to fill your time and your mind with doing lots of things, you know, just working, or doing these activities. And I'm driving too far. It's like, you know, you're going all over the place. And then he says, I'd like to change my point of view. It's like he becomes aware that, oh, all of this is emptiness. I'm just trying to avoid the emptiness. And then he says, I feel so lonely. I'm waiting for you, but nothing ever happens. And I wonder. And then he says, I wonder how, I wonder why. Yesterday you told me about the blue, blue sky, and all that I can see is just a yellow lemon tree. I'm turning my head up and down. I'm turning around, and all that I can see is just another lemon tree. So this makes me think of the guy looking out the cell, his prison cell, and seeing this lemon tree, this yellow lemon tree. And then he says, I'm turning my head up and down. So he's being forced to look up, to think about higher things. And then he's looking down, looking at his current condition. So he's being forced to think about higher ideas, higher principles, a higher calling. And then thinking about the current situation he's in. And then he's saying, I'm turning around, like going in circles. And all that I can see is just another lemon tree. And then he says, dap dap do 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 dap dap and a whole bunch of daps and whatever. And then he says, I'm sitting here, I miss the power. I like to go out taking a shower. But there's a heavy cloud inside my head. I feel so tired, put myself into bed. Well, nothing ever happens. And I wonder. It's interesting, he says, I'm sitting here, I miss the power. And you can imagine a person who is who's been, you know, gangbanging and all that stuff. And now he's sitting in that isolation cell, and he's saying, I miss the power, you know, all that power that I had when I was gangbanging and or doing all these white collar crimes or whatever. But I don't have access to that anymore.
and but there's a heavy cloud inside my head. I feel so tired, put myself into bed, well, nothing ever happens, and I wonder. It's like saying, I was doing all these things, having all this power, but nothing was really happening in my life. I was going nowhere. And then he says, and this is the phrase that prompted me to think about this song, isolation is not good for me. Isolation, I don't want to sit on the lemon tree. And then he said, I'm stepping around in the desert of joy. Baby, anyhow, I'll get another toy and everything will happen. And you wonder. So he's starting to dream about changing his life, saying, now he's stepping around in the desert of joy. Like, I'm in the wilderness right now, but I am coming back to life from the emptiness I felt throughout my whole life. And now I'm still in the wilderness, but I'm entering into joy because I'm beginning to see that I have to follow a purpose, and I'm seeing the purpose I have to follow. And then it says, and baby, and how I'll get another toy. So it's like, I'm going to change the thing that I've been distracting myself with and get something new to pursue, and everything will happen. And you wonder. And then it said, I wonder how, I wonder why. Yesterday you told me about the blue, blue sky, and all that I can see is just another lemon tree. I'm turning my head up and down. I'm turning, 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 turning around. And all that I can see is just a yellow lemon tree. And I wonder, wonder. And then it just goes on to say, I wonder how, I wonder why. Yesterday you told me about the blue, blue sky, and all that I can see, and all that I can see, and all that I can see. It's just a yellow lemon tree. And this song, you can take it from the perspective also of the people who are seeking the truth. We're waiting for everybody else to respond, and they're waiting. You know, just like this guy who's waiting for his girlfriend to show up, and he never showed. Like, I'm waiting for America to show up to the dance of truth, and America just is not showing up. It didn't show. And so it says, yesterday you told me about the blue, blue sky. It's like, America was aware that it had a manifest destiny, that it had a calling to do something great. And it would talk about the blue, blue sky, the greatness of America, and blah, blah, blah. But all I can see now is a yellow lemon tree. That's all America is right now, yellow lemon tree. And it's what the truth seekers, you know, have been experiencing. They were envisioning something great, waiting for something great, and they knew that America knew, they knew that America knew about its potential greatness. And we were all filled with hope, waiting for this to happen. But it never happened. We waited, and America never showed. And that's the situation we're in. And we're 6 months away from America permanently being dead. It's like we're waiting. It's like I'm waiting by the door, and we know that we have 6 months, like let's say the months are hours. We have 6 hours left. And I'm just waiting because I want to make it official. I want to leave, close the door, and never come back. Because we've been waiting. We've been waiting, and nothing has happened. So I hope that even though we've talked about a whole bunch of things, that you see that are all interconnected. It has to do with accountability, purpose. When you have those two things, then you can go out and conquer and do great things. And in the case of the prison system, if we can get people to realize a sense of accountability for what they've done and force them to seek a sense of purpose, then when they go out of prison, then they can go out and conquer and do things and do what's right and make something of their lives and achieve and succeed. And that will do much more than all the whitewashing liberal reform that liberals are always proposing that does nothing, doesn't change any life, doesn't transform anyone in any way. It only creates more chaos and more destruction and more purposelessness. So that's more or less what we were talking about, accountability, purpose in order to conquer. And we talked about those things in the context of these two stories, the IRS story and what happened to Chai McBride in 1988. Thank you very much for listening.